Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps. Episode 124 for June 16th, 2010. Xenos. It's time for Floss Weekly, the weekly show about free, libre, open source software. Open source, free software, whatever you want to call it, we talk about it. This week, I'm talking to a couple of very special guests, but first let me introduce one of the many members of the rotating panel of co-hosts. This week is someone I'm really looking forward to talking with because he's been a guest on this show already twice. It's none other than the one and only Simon Phipps. Hello, Simon.
Hi there, Randall. It's great to be on the show, on the delivering end rather than on the receiving end for a change.
I don't know. Is that really delivering? Because you're receiving what our guests are going to say, right?
Well, there's that too, yes. It's a great pleasure actually doing webcasts and doing live radio because you do get to have this dynamic conversation where you know you have to measure every word because people are listening to them all over the world, and yet you're here in a live relationship having a dialogue.
It is very cool. Like I said, this is a labor of love for me, and I just keep doing it week after week and bringing on great guests. In fact, we got a couple great guests today, both from the same organization. That's good because otherwise we'd have to have two different shows at the same time. But we have with us Matt Ray and Mark Hinkle, and they work with Xenos, which is an open source platform for monitoring systems, making sure they're up and running, making sure they're talking to each other, all sorts of things in that relationship there. Apparently, though, it's a typical, you know, premium or freemium sort of model where you basically can have the free open source version, and then, of course, they have a company behind it to commercialize the work that they're doing in the open source community. But before we get into that, I've seen a lot of tweets from you recently about something called OSI, Open Source Initiative. Can you talk about that?
I can do that. So I was honored to be elected to the board of this thing called the Open Source Initiative a little bit earlier in the year. OSI was founded in 1998 to be the pragmatic projection of the idea of software freedom that businesses were able to embrace without having to get all philosophical on the world. And it did that by coming up with a list of criteria by which a license could be called an open source license. Mm-hmm. So over the last decade, OSI has been providing a free resource through its nonprofit corporation to help businesses check their licenses out, validate them as freedom-loving open source licenses, and tell the world which licenses are good and which licenses are bad.
Very good. And where would somebody find out more about this?
You find out more about that at opensource.org, a very easy to remember address. And that's where you'll be able to read the posting that I did just at the beginning of this week, all about how we're revising OSI. After 10 years, it's time for it to have a coat of new paint or probably even some new construction work done. And I would like every listener to Floss Weekly to consider joining in and lending a hand as we rebuild OSI.
Can you give me the top two bullet points on that?
The top bullet point is that OSI was set up defining licenses, and really we're pretty much done now with open source licenses. We know largely that we want things to be under the GPL or under the Apache license or under BSD. Most other licenses aren't very interesting because they dilute the code that the community can share. OSI is, however, the steward of that list of licenses, and so we can't just turn the light off and go away. So we need to come up with a new way of handling licenses. And then OSI has been just the board for 10 years. It's been the 10 people who are board members doing all the work. And we need to spread the base so that there are more people who believe that they are counting in advocating for free Libre and open source software and are making a difference. So we're going to convert OSI into a member organization with the board elected by the members in some way. And one of the great tasks that needs doing is to join my governance committee at OSI and help define the new governance rules.
Wow. Sounds like a very worthwhile mission. I'm looking forward to seeing the results of that and participating as much as I can with a copious spare time that I actually have. Let's go ahead and bring our guests on the line. First, we'll start with Matt. Matt, where are we calling to you from?
You're calling me in Austin, Texas. I'm calling from the Zenos Austin office. We also have an office in Annapolis, Maryland, which is our headquarters. But that's where I'm calling from.
Very cool. Very cool. So Matt joins us from Austin, sounds like. And Mark, where are we talking to you from?
I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina today.
Very cool. That looks really complex behind you there on the video. Are you in an office or something?
I am in my home office, yes.
Cool. Very good. And wanted to welcome you guys to this week's Floss Weekly. And I introduced Zenos just a little bit at the beginning, but Matt, why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit longer explanation?
Okay. Well, Zenos is an open source network monitoring platform. So if you have any sort of infrastructure, you know, network devices, servers, databases, applications, we can monitor them. If they've got an IP address, we can, you know, keep an eye on them for you. And that goes for virtual infrastructure and stuff running in the cloud as well.
So it's basically a monitoring platform. If I have, say, 100 boxes or 1,000 boxes, the tricky part is being able to see when they're up and running and make sure all the services are responding to all the things like that. And Zenos sort of brings this all together for me, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so what's the history of Zenos? How did it get started and where is it now?
You want to take that one, Mark?
Sure. Back in the mid-2000s, our CTO, Eric Dahl, worked in a network operations center, and he was using some commercial software to monitor his network, and he wasn't quite happy with any of it. So he started to write his own and went out on his own as a consultant and wrote it for a cable company. And in February of 2006, we launched Zenos Core on SourceForge and put it out there for feedback, and it was pretty rough. And over the last 4 years, we've released 8 major releases. We're used in over 20,000 organizations around the world, every continent. And we have a really great community of about 80,000 plus users that contribute to the project and help us distribute and develop it.
Yeah, you said so, every kind of. Does that include Antarctica?
It absolutely includes Antarctica.
Does. Really?
Three installations in Antarctica.
Wow.
We're very proud of that.
They have computers down there? I guess they must for doing research and stuff.
Yep.
Have you ever had to go down and visit that, the installation?
I haven't had the fortune yet. Mostly I stick to North America, mostly.
So how big would I have to be to need something like this?
Well, you know, the nice thing is since it's open source, you know, you can get your feet wet with, you know, I run it at home. I've got, you know, 4 or 5, you know, computers. I've got an Xbox, a Wii, you know, iPhones. I can watch all those things, see when they come and go from my network. And then, you know, the nice thing is that there's, you know, it doesn't really change once you start to scale. So we have, you know, people doing 10 devices like me, or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 or, you know, 20, 30, 40,000.
Yeah. So, okay. So it's pretty simple to get started. Now, what does monitoring actually buy me? I mean, I kind of get the sense that it's something that if I want to know that something's happening and then be notified if something breaks, but is that all, or is there like logging and stuff? I mean, what's involved in this?
So, you know, typically in a large organization, you're going to have a wide variety of devices deployed. And so, you know, Once you start providing a service, you know, like a hosted web application or something, you know, that is actually your business. And so monitoring, you know, all the hardware underneath it, you know, making sure everything is running, that's essential to how your business operates. And so, you know, monitoring gets you, you know, kind of the heartbeat of you know, what's going on behind the scenes. And so if you're on top of things, you can, you know, cut out problems before they, you know, really bite you. And so, you know, what Zenos does is it, you know, lets you fine tune, you know, what you're paying attention to, what you care about, you know, and customize how we monitor your environment, you know, so you can actually tailor it to what you do.
So let me bring this home a little bit then, because I have one of my clients is Insight Cruises, the people that put conferences on cruise ships, and I help manage, babysit their web server and their booking engine. And we moved to OpenSolaris about 6 months ago, a year ago, I think almost. And for some reason, Apache keeps crashing every once in a while. So I wrote this stupid little script. It's about 10 lines long. All it does is it constantly does a curl about every 30 seconds to make sure the Apache is still running. And if it doesn't, it sends me email that texts me. Is that like right. A baby version of what you're talking about?
Well, yeah. So if you were monitoring that infrastructure, you know, with Zenos, you could start at, hey, let's monitor the OpenSolaris box. You know, make sure it's up and running. Mm-hmm. Make sure it's not overloaded, how the CPU is doing, file systems, that kind of stuff. You could start watching the Apache process. So if it goes down, you could restart it. You know, you can send out alerts if something happens. And then the Apache serving up your web application. So you could do, you know, some simple screen scraping if you want. You know, see what's on the front page. You could check the port directly. You know, actually, you know, connect to the port, run a regex against the output. Or you could do something more complex, like a synthetic web transaction, where you actually follow a click stream, where, you know, you script, hey, I'm going to click here, and then I'm going to look for this output, and then I'm going to click there and look for that output. So, you know, you could really go from the, you know, bare metal, you know, down from the hardware all the way up to, you know, what you are delivering.
And obviously, and in order to monitor the box itself running, I'd have to have that running on a different box.
Yeah. I mean, typically, Zenos sits in a data center, you know, where, you know, where you're going to install it on its own box. So it can you know, watch all the other boxes and take care of them.
Yeah. Interesting.
So very interesting stuff you got there. And I'm pretty sure that I need that on the computers that I'm running around the building around me here. You mentioned it was open source and that you have a great community. Could you tell me a bit about that community?
Okay. Well, so, you know, I'm the community manager. So my job is to go out and help people succeed with open source. You know, so we have a community site, Zenos.org, and, you know, that's where our users come. We've got forums for them. We've got, you know, wiki. We have official documentation that we provide. You know, they're coming in and they're writing extensions for Zenos and sharing those with each other. And then we have a very active IRC channel as well. So, you know, all those things are our community coming together. And then Zenos, the company, tries to, you know, provide a little bit of a framework for them to succeed. You know, so we're constantly putting out new releases and giving them early access to everything, and, you know, and they have, you know, full access to our source control, and, you know, they can, you know, watch the builds as they're coming out. They can, you know, build them themselves. They have direct access to our ticket tracking. So, you know, we use Track, so they can go and enter their own tickets and, you know, let us know what's wrong, and they can submit patches as well.
So you, on your website, you describe your model as commercial open source, the best of both worlds. What does that mean? What is the relationship between the open source code your community is working with and the licensed code that you are selling?
Okay. So, typically we refer to them as Zenos Core and Zenos Enterprise, where Zenos Core is the open source version. So that is what, you know, the majority of development is on that platform. And then Zenos Enterprise is some commercial extensions on top of that. So we have an extension system called Zenpax. And so Enterprise is a set of Zenpax provided by Zenos Incorporated, and then we provide support. You know, and that's actually what a lot of our customers are coming for. You know, that most of them they start with Zenos Core, and you know, they have success with it, and then, you know, someone's like, well, you know, maybe we need to have someone we can call if something goes wrong. You know, and so that's, you know, a lot of our big commercial installations are like that. You know, where Enterprise adds support for things that, you know, not every home user is going to need, things like, you know, vCenter or Cisco UCS, you know, some of the high-end, you know, really esoteric stuff.
So if I was a big corporation using your software, do I have the freedom to use that software without having a contract with you for my production environment, or are you going to be making it very hard for me to do that?
No, absolutely. The Zenos Core is licensed GPLv2, so we have a number of very large installations running that don't, you know, they don't give us a dime, and we're happy about that. I mean, you know, the vast majority of Zenos users are using Zenos Core. And, you know, kind of our business model is about getting it in the hands of everyone, because, you know, some percentage of them are going to need support. And so we have a lot of, you know, very large core installations that, you know, might be doing 10, 20,000 devices that, you know, they don't send us a dollar. And then we have, you know, sites like Slashdot or, you know, in SourceForge, one of our customers, hosting.com, is doing 24,000 devices before they became a customer. You know, and so there, you know, there are a number of really big organizations running it, you know, whether it's universities or nonprofits, just. And then the really great thing is if you go to like our IRC and our forums, our customers are interacting with our community. You know, I mean, they're all part of the same community. So you have, you know, people who are paying Zenos for, you know, support and additional features. They're in our IRC channel trading tips and tricks with, you know, people who aren't, you know, giving us anything. And that's great.
Can you give me an idea of what the paid for extensions actually are? And are they proprietary or are they open source licensed? And what sort of things do they do?
Okay. Well, some of the commercial extensions that we offer are things like I mentioned Cisco UCS. That's currently in beta, but that's getting a lot of development. We have some Cisco call center stuff, VMware, virtual center monitoring, some extra reports, things like Active Directory, Exchange, SQL Server, NetApp, you know, just kind of, the kind of hardware and applications that you find in large enterprises. And then the licensing on them is, it is a commercial license where, but our enterprise customers do have access to the source. So, you know, they do submit patches to the enterprise extensions as well as patches back to core.
So if I decide that I want to stop paying, you know, times are hard at the moment. Maybe I've decided that I can't afford to actually pay a subscription for Zenos anymore. Am I able to just stop paying you and carry on using my software, or will the license prevent me from doing that?
The license will prevent you from continuing on with the enterprise extensions, but you can always go right back to core, and we make it easy to migrate back and forth between them.
So now tell me about your community. In your community, do you have any competitors?
Sure. I mean, there are. We're not the largest open source monitoring application. There's Nagios, which is kind of the grandfather of applications, which, you know, a lot of people are coming from a Nagios background when they convert to Zenos. And there are other applications like OpenNMS or Groundworks or Hyperic. We're all open source, so we're kind of like cousins a bit, because really we're trying to get displaced people from tools like IBM and HP and BMC and CA, you know, where people are, you know, they're paying a whole lot for applications that they might not be using all the features of, when, you know, there's something that's open source that can do exactly the same things.
You know, and that's really the remarkable thing that I find about good large open source projects like this, is just how the quality is no different. In fact, I say in some ways open source is better for a lot of projects, because there's all these people that are willing to contribute and make modifications and building on top of it and bug fixes on their own, instead of waiting for some engineers in Redmond to finish the release.
Right. And actually one of our commercial customers was using one of the big four, is what they call them, the big four networking monitoring companies of, you know, IBM, BMC, HP, and CA. Mm-hmm. They were doing a trial, and the trial had been going on for 18 months, and they weren't getting the patches they wanted. And so they put Zenos core in shop, you know, next to this application, and they started monitoring the same things. And they actually run a large top 10 news site. And come election night, the commercial competitor crashed. And, Zenos Core kept trucking along. And so they were able to monitor their infrastructure, stay on top of any fires before they got out of control, and, promptly kicked the commercial application out the door. And 30 days later, we're a customer.
Wow. Yeah. Very cool. So what's the... what are some of the things that can be monitored? I know we kind of talked a little bit about load average and things like that, but what can you give some other examples of what people can monitor with this thing?
Well, I mean, the really nice thing is since it's open source, and, you know, we kind of give you all the pieces to do whatever you want, people go, they monitor some pretty crazy things. I mean, you know, you have your, you know, kind of standard IT infrastructure where you have, you know, a bunch of Linux boxes, you know, some OpenSolaris, some FreeBSD, and some Windows boxes. And then, you know, your network hardware. And then people start to get into kind of, you know, what is a little more, you know, fringe, where they might say, well, you know, we have some access points. And actually, you know, one of our users has data buoys. You know, he has these buoys out in the North Atlantic that are returning data. And so he uses Zenos to track those, you know, the health of his buoys moving around in the North Atlantic Ocean. You know, cool. Or, you know, another user is monitoring dog tracks in England. You know, the scoreboards and the gates and making sure that everything is still running. You know, I mean, you could do just about anything.
So how difficult is this to install? I presume there's like the standard Linux RPMs or something, right?
Right, right. So we provide RPMs for Red Hat and CentOS, and then we also have a stack installer that includes all of our dependencies. You know, so we run Zenos is a Python application, so we run on top of Zope, which is a Python application server, and then mm-hmm. we also use MySQL and RD tool, and so our stack installer contains all of our dependencies in a single binary, and that makes it really easy to, you know, test out Zenos without having it, you know, step on anything else. And it's also really easy for upgrades. And, you know, that's what we recommend for most users. You know, and then we also have, I mentioned the RPMs. We have Debs available and, you know, Tarballs. So you can go in and build, you know, for your platform if you need to. And you can always, you know, run directly from Subversion.
Cool. So that would be like on the main platform. You'd have all this large stack of stuff. You wouldn't need that on all the monitored boxes, though, right?
No. So that's a kind of important thing to point out is Zenos is agentless. So in monitoring, there's kind of two schools of thought. There's an agent where you have something that is installed on each machine that, you know, watches the health and then reports back. And then there's agentless, which uses remote protocols like SNMP, SSH, WMI for Windows monitoring, you know, Telnet, JMX if you're monitoring Java. So we don't actually have a footprint on those machines. So if those machines, you know, all you have to do is turn on SSH or turn on SNMP, and then you point Zenos at those machines, give it the right, you know, credentials to monitor things, and you know, and we can keep track of the health of that box. You know, we don't have to have another piece of software on that machine.
Unless there was something that wasn't provided by SNMP then.
Right. Well, that's the nice thing about, you know, SNMP is it's actually quite easy to extend. And we make it easy to extend what you're monitoring, you know, by you can, you know, just plug in custom commands or custom SNMP calls to actually pull things that aren't exposed, you know. And then, you know, we make it easy to share those back with other community members. So if you have, you know, some router or, you know, switch that isn't well documented or, you know, and out of the box it acts a little bit funny, well, you can go and, you know, track down the particular OIDs, start monitoring those and export those and share them with other community members.
Cool. Now, going back to my example of monitoring this Apache server that's running on the OpenSolaris box, and I would probably then want to install Zenos on my FreeBSD box and then have it monitor the OpenSolaris box then.
Sure. I mean, we have FreeBSD is not like one of our actively supported platforms, but, you know, as you're probably aware, the FreeBSD users are quite vocal. And mm-hmm. so they've been working together and they're working on a proper port for Zenos. But right now they have, you know, kind of source build instructions. But yeah, you can install on a FreeBSD, monitor the OpenSolaris box and anything else you have.
That sounds really cool. I'm going to have to, I think I know what I'm doing in the next half hour after this show. That'll be great.
I better let the FreeBSD guys know you're on their way.
Oh, they know I'm coming. They know I'm coming. So there's a source packages that I download, install that. Is there a lot of configurations, configuration done by the web or by shell script or configuration scripts?
Right. So that's kind of one of the things that differentiates Zenos from a lot of, you know, the older open source projects is we don't actually have you touch a lot of files. So, you know, from the application on a fresh install, we're going to say, you know, hey, you need to create some users, and then we're going to go and discover your hardware. So you would give it a range of IP addresses that you want to watch, or you know, individual ones if necessary. And then you enter credentials, you know, for WMI if you're monitoring Windows boxes, for SSH and SNMP community strings. And then what Zenos will do is go in and ping all those IP addresses you provided, and any that respond, it will attempt to use those credentials against them and add them to the system. And then you can go and say, well, hey, these boxes are Linux boxes. I'm going to monitor them as Linux. Or, you know, these boxes are, this is my OpenSolaris box. Let's move it over here. And so we actually go and find all your hardware, and you just, you know, configure it through the UI. You don't actually have to touch configuration files and restart and whatnot. And then, you know, and if you need to, you can also, you know, import from a big text file, you know, where you've got a spreadsheet somewhere listing all your hardware, and you just want to export it and push it right into Zenos. We'll do that too.
So cool. I'm very interested that you've mentioned OpenSolaris a number of times, and that you weren't thrown when Randall turned out to be running it. So I'm lucky enough to be on the OpenSolaris governing board at the moment. And I wonder, how is that OpenSolaris support that you've got there? Is that something that you're supporting as a company, or is that something that's coming in from the community?
So we actually have both. You know, our community... we had a community developer who wrote an OpenSolaris Zen pack. You know, Zen packs are extensions to Zenos that uses SSH to monitor OpenSolaris. You know, SNMP is supported pretty much out of the box because OpenSolaris uses NetSNMP, which is an open source standard. Solaris itself doesn't have a very good SNMP daemon, so you can use SSH. But anyway, so yeah, monitoring OpenSolaris, you know, you just go grab the Zen pack if you want to use SSH or SNMP out of the box. And then in enterprise, we have another SSH Zen pack for Solaris and OpenSolaris that supports, you know, some of the things that the community one doesn't cover. And actually, we like the community ones so much that we hired the developer.
That's always good news. On the OpenSolaris one, are you digging down into the operating system using the native features like dtrace to... look at the real state of the machine rather than just what the software has chosen to tell you about?
It doesn't actually dig that far down. I mean, it's mostly using shell commands like ps, df, I didn't write the OpenSolaris one, so I'm not familiar, but, you know, if it was Linux, it would be looking at into proc, pulling information out of there. So I'm not exactly sure what the OpenSolaris one does, but it's going to provide, you know, your interfaces, your file systems, software inventory, a little bit of hardware inventory, performance, load, that kind of things.
Are you able to go out and run custom scripts that you've written, for example,
Absolutely.
using dtrace or using the equivalent features that are available in BSD and in Linux?
Yes, yes. So one of the things that we have, you can add custom performance templates to Zenos, which in a nutshell means we can run a command on a remote box, and then whatever output that generates, we can use that to generate events and populate graphs. So, typically, you know, out of the box, your OpenSolaris it's fairly vanilla, but perhaps it's running some application on it, or you want to watch things like perhaps a temperature or fan speed, something that's not covered out of the box. Well, you can just add an SSH command that goes SSHs to that box and runs that command locally on the box and brings the results back to Zenos. And that's really easy. You know, and that's the same way if you've got like a large Nagios installation, you can just plug in any sort of Nagios scripts that you've already written. You can plug them right back into Zenos the same way.
Right. So I'm very excited by the fact that you've been hiring guys from the OpenSolaris community. Are there other things that you're doing to support the communities that are supporting you, like sponsoring
Sure.
conferences or donating money to their fighting funds?
Yes, yes, and yes. We've hired a number of community members. Whenever we have the budget for new employees, you know, it's great to be able to go to your community and find people who, you know, already are familiar with it. They're already have their hands on the source. And so, you know, a number of our really great hires have come out of the community. And then as far as like sponsoring other projects, Zenos is a sponsor of a number of their other projects, things like RD Tool, MRTG, the Twisted, the Python networking framework. And then as far as like events, you know, I just came back from Southeast Linux Fest. And Southeast Linux Fest, you know, we were one of the sponsors for that. Randall was at the Texas Linux Fest. Zenos was one of the first sponsor of that event. I was actually one of the organizers, but you know, we sponsor Scale, Ohio Linux Fest, Linux Fest Northwest. You know, it's just a large number of events. The Lisa, the Usenix Lisa event. So you know, if it's an open source community event, and you know, we think that they're going to be, you know, sysadmins, which a lot of Linux users are, chances are we're going to try to show up. And so that's where I was lucky enough to run into Randall.
Right. So a lot of the places you're naming there sound like they might be American. Do you ever do anything over my side of the pond or anywhere else in the world?
You know, we keep looking at it. It's a bit of a commitment, but I think, you know, we've been looking at either like FOSDEM or there's another big show in Germany that we're looking at, or perhaps going south down to Brazil. You know, I hear they have a lot of really big open source events down there. I mean, probably in the next year, we're going to try to do at least one international show.
Absolutely. You should join us down at FISLAY down in Porto Alegre, which is coming up in July. And then I think the conference you were thinking of is LinuxTag, which has just happened over in Germany. Are all good things to go to. Often when I hear people say that, I do wonder whether you're driving the community or the community is driving you. Do you think that that there is any sense in which things are only happening in the places where you're stimulating them, or do you see activity for your software arising all over the world?
It's really kind of a push and pull. So, like, you know, Zenos Incorporated, a lot of their development is targeted at, you know, things that their customers want. You know, and so, you know, those features, some of them are enterprise and some of them are community. And then, you know, but the community is a great test bed of new ideas. So they're always trying out, you know, things that, you know, as a commercial entity, it might not be on our radar yet, you know, where, you know, our community is, you know, they're running on platforms that we don't have the resources to support, or, you know, they're trying out hardware that we don't have our hands on yet. And so, you know, they go and they, you know, they innovate. You know, they innovate on top of a platform that, you know, we try to keep in good shape for them. And that's kind of it's really a symbiotic relationship.
Pretty good stuff. So how much of your code has come in from your community, and how much of it has come from people that you employ?
Most of it is through our employees. You know, there's an idea called the power law of contribution, where, you know, really the majority of users, like 90-95%, they use the application, you know, and this is true for other projects like, you know, like Linux or Wikipedia, where, you know, the vast majority of users that come in, they just use it. They don't really touch it. They don't look at the insides. You know, that's where their involvement ends. And then, you know, the next layer is, hey, well, they're becoming active in the forums, or they're on IRC, they're helping other users, you know, they're getting hands-on. And then kind of the next step is they're opening tickets and they're submitting patches. And so it goes, you know, there are fewer and fewer people as you move along this curve. And then, you know, typically the people who are on the far right of the curve are the ones we like to hire. So, you know, most of the source is written by Zenos, but most of the tickets and patches are, you know, that are coming through Track. Probably about half of them are from the community.
Yeah, speaking of sources, so you have, this is mostly written in Python then?
Yes.
And
yes,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the application itself is Python. There's definitely some C in there. A lot of our native Windows monitoring is from the Samba project. So, you know, there's some C. And then our application is a web application. So there's, you know, definitely a lot of HTML and JavaScript.
Yeah. Cool. So if I wanted to contribute, I would need to know all that stuff, or maybe just whatever's appropriate to it, right?
Not everything. So, you know, I mentioned, these command data sources where people can add their own commands. Those don't have to be in Python. And so, you know, a lot of those are written in C or Perl, or, you know, we don't have any Smalltalk ones yet, but I look forward to those. you know, so it's really anything that any language you feel comfortable with, you know, that is going to be on that box that you're monitoring. You know, you can go and call out to that, get whatever output you need, and send it back to Zenos. And we also have
go ahead.
We also have Yeah, remote APIs. So, you know, if you don't want to talk Python, if you just want to, you know, stick with your language and talk to us via our REST or XML RPC APIs, you're free to do that. So there's a Ruby client that's out there, you know, for just dealing with Xenos via Ruby. Yeah.
So, Matt, I've seen you present at conferences. Mark, you also present at conferences?
Yeah, around. I'll be at OSCON next month, and the Linux Foundation is having an event in August, and I'll be presenting about integrating Xenos and systems management tools with complementary technologies like open source config management from Chef and Puppet, things like that.
Well, that sounds interesting. I'm going to have to see if I can attend that session. I'm also going to be at OSCON, obviously, as well. How would you contrast Xenos with, say, Nagios and the other big tools? Is it roughly in the same space, or is there things that Xenos does better than the rest of those?
I think that Nagios is by far the most popular for simple monitoring, and it's got a huge install base, but it's primarily in availability monitoring, while Xenos, sort of the inspiration that our CTO had for Xenos was one complete tool that gives you insight not only into availability and giving you alerting, which is what Nagios does, but also give you that performance graphing, which is normally in the open source world is supplied by Cacti, which mm-hmm. is a common combination of Nagios and Cacti. But then the extensibility and having this idea that all your infrastructure is interrelated, and we create a model of that, and we understand the dependencies between the network and the server. And by having collection of not just at the hardware and network level, but the application and the server level, and having this model that maps all these dependencies, we give you sort of a complete tool that's extensible to do everything. And that's probably what makes us a little bit more unique than some tools are really excellent at network monitoring, but not so much at application monitoring. And some tools are great at server monitoring, but don't understand, you know, different layers of the stack. And that's probably the difference. I think that there's a lot of great open source tools out there that we can take inspiration from, but we like to consider ourselves as having one of the most complete views of all your infrastructure.
Okay, I've just been asked, how would you contrast this with Zabbix? Are you familiar with Zabbix?
We are.
I'm a little... Go ahead, Mark.
Go ahead, Matt.
Okay, well, Zabbix is another open source project, another network monitoring application. They use an agent, so that's one of the big differentiators. You know, so with Zabbix, you're going to need to install an agent on each box. You know, and I mentioned earlier that we're agentless. I believe they're a PHP application.
Uh-oh, I think we lost the sound there. Mark, can you take that question?
Sure. I think Matt was touching on the base that they collect information via their agent. Now, I'm not as familiar with Zabbix, but they've been around for a long time, and I look at them as actually they have a good track record of development and features. I believe they're European or is the people that support them and have a small team that supports the project and offers support and services. But just like us, they're GPL software that a lot of people seem to like. I think they have whenever I've looked at demos, they have a slick interface and a reasonable amount of progress. And they've been around since, I believe, quite a bit longer than Xenos, though their footprint, I don't know how big it is.
Mm-hmm. How many boxes can I monitor with one? I mean, am I going to have to eventually scale horizontally and have multiple monitoring platforms?
Well, it's the answer to that is always it depends, and mm-hmm. that's a matter of what kind of data you're collecting. So if you're collecting availability data via SNMP, that's very lightweight, and you can do a lot of say, a large cluster Linux servers and hundreds or thousands with a single box. If you start collecting deeper information, for example, if you're collecting information from Windows boxes via WMI or doing synthetic transactions that are heavier, you're not going to be able to scale. And it's also a factor of how often you pull. So if you pull every 5 minutes, that's an MP data. You can do quite a few, but if you were doing trying to monitor a couple hundred Windows boxes, pulling perf counters and other deep metrics, it might be a lot less. And it's also, once again, a factor of the polling period. If you did it once an hour, you could probably do thousands. If you're doing it once every 5 minutes, it's probably hundreds.
In terms of network topology, does that mean your monitoring machine has to be able to connect to all these other boxes, or do you have like a proxy server you can plug in the middle?
You could VPN into another a network to collect data and map and do network topology that way. We would pull your routing tables from your routers and from your servers to create that model. Let's see.
Yeah, I mean, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Here's Matt's okay. Back.
Sorry. Yeah. So I mean, if as long as the Xeno server can reach the other machine at some point. So you know, I think Mark was getting at if you need to, you can open a VPN tunnel to another network and then put a remote collector on that network that reports back to the Xeno server. You know, so as long as you have some way of eventually getting to those IP addresses, you know, you can monitor it.
Great.
So I'm actually going to take the conversation in a different direction here. Mark, I've been reading your blog recently. You've been writing about cloud lock-in. And I see that you talk a little bit about three different kinds of lock-in. Would you be able to just run us quickly through your argument about why there doesn't seem to be a way to stop it, but the solution could be gaining understanding of what you're committing to?
Sure. And actually, I don't really have an argument yet as much as I'm quoting a lot of smarter people than I. But I think that we, as you talk about the cloud, and that's one of our big focuses, is the ability to manage this evolving infrastructure. You have three kinds of lock-in that I think people should be considering when they adopt cloud infrastructure. One of them is platform lock-in. So are you if you commit to the Amazon platform, are those virtual machines, or in their language, Amazon machine images, portable to a VMware hosted cluster or an open source Xen cluster or Eucalyptus or KVM, which are KVM is the virtualization technology used by Ubuntu's cloud, and Xen is the one that is packaged with Eucalyptus, which is one of the popular open source cloud infrastructure platforms. Then the next one is, and the really smart guy on this one is James Urquhart, who's from Cisco, who's talks about data lock-in. Data lock-in is your data portable across clouds, and that's always been a I think one of the big concerns of people who are using hosted infrastructure is, do they own their data and can it move from platform to platform? And the one that I'm most interested in, by virtue of being a systems management guy, is the tools lock-in. Right. And you know, do your tools work? If you have virtual infrastructure that you want to move from Amazon to maybe Rackspace to your own internal cloud running on Eucalyptus, can those tools handle all of those situations? Because once you move the infrastructure, that's probably what people are most concerned about. But then where are you left holding the bag without visibility into your the tools that you're managing, especially, or into the platform or the data, are those tools portable? And I think that's one of those things that is an afterthought and should be a forethought when you move around. Right. From.
So what do you think lock-in actually is in this context? Is it having a choice of suppliers? Is it having a choice of technologies? How would you really say lock-in is defined in your argument?
I think that it's more the, even though you talk about lock-in, and I could give you a really simple example of someone who has a Amazon hosted instance and they want to move to perhaps Red Hat's KVM instance. You can move that infrastructure, but it's the level of inconvenience of transferring from one to the other. So is that, and I don't know what that threshold of inconvenience is, because no matter what, when you move from one vendor to another in any kind of context, there's a honeymoon period in getting to know the new systems. But I think it's a matter of having that inconvenience of migrating be very low, as well as a large number of suppliers for that product or service, in this case, cloud-hosted applications or infrastructure in general.
Right. So as you've been working out how to design the community interaction for your company, what steps have you taken to prevent your customers suffering from lock-in on your own product?
I think that's the beauty of, and Matt's mentioned the our Zenpack framework. So we have two sorts of aspects of our product. We have the plumbing, which we've designed to accept information and monitor all sorts of infrastructure, and then we have what we feel is an easy to use, extensible plugin framework that allows people to extend our product as new types of technology come out very easily. So 4 years ago when we started Zenos, we had this idea of Zenpacks, but Google App Engine wasn't around, Amazon EC2 wasn't around. I don't believe that Memcache had reached the pervasive use that it has today. And by having an easy-to-use, extensible platform like that, our users have been able to extend Zenos as new technologies evolve, and it fits into our model. And so the tool itself it's common. It's got a common interface. We've got the ability to create templates and all these plumbing and platform things that have been easily extensible. And then we've worked with our community to allow them to extend as IT changes. 10 years ago, you weren't instrumenting for VMware. And today, I would say the vast majority of large enterprises are using VMware. And that's one thing that our community has done to extend Zenos, as well as one of our enterprise offerings is deep VMware monitoring.
Mark, I've got a much simpler question for you. That was a great answer, sure. By the way. I appreciate that. Emacs or VI?
VI.
Yeah, how about that?
I'm Emacs.
I'm just an Emacs guy. I'm a man. Sorry.
Yay, Emacs.
I'm a man of simple tastes.
And obviously, you need to know some text editor to help out with your project, but what else do you need to know? You need to know where to go. So where would people go to find out more about Zenos?
They can find us at www.zenos.org. And there's a wealth of information there.
Very good. Very good. Well, thank you guys both for being on today, Matt and Mark. Any last thing you want to tell our audience before we let you go?
I welcome everyone to check out Zenos.org. And we have a webinar every 2 weeks for new users where I just, kind of give you a guided tour of it. And I'll be at Velocity next week and the DevOps Day. So it's a community developer and operator session next Friday in California. If you're going to be in the area, look me up.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, thank you guys both for being on the show. Well, we look forward. Well, I know what I'm doing right after I get off here is I'm going to be downloading and installing. So I appreciate you guys coming on and giving me more information about what Zenos is all about. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Great.
Thanks for having us.
That was Matthew. Got to scroll. There we go. That was Matt Ray and Mark Hinkle of the Zenos organization, and talking to us about their wonderful platform support. What do you think, Simon?
Well, I do think I'm going to go straight over and download a copy. I have a feeling I'm going to be steering clear of the enterprise extensions for the time being. If I'm not going to be able to keep on using them if I can't pay the bills.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. You know, you've got to fund open source somehow. And I know you've, on the show as a previous guest, you've talked a little bit about what has to happen for that to work. They've open sourced a good core of it. So people can do useful things. Sounds like a lot of large customers are just using the open source version.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's some good stuff going on in their open source work. They're doing what every open source company should do and hiring developers from the community. They're respecting community contributions. If I was doing my open source scorecard, I would be giving them pretty good marks, I should think.
Very good. Very good. Well, speaking of open source scorecard, let's look at the upcoming guest list. We have next week's show. I'm going to be at Yapsy next week, and I'm actually going to be taping a show off hours and plugging it into the week's feed, but we're just still arranging that, so I'm not going to announce who it is yet. Following that week, I'll have Anthony Bryan, who heads the Metalink project. Metalink is a universal identifier so that things like torrents and web clients know how to download resources listed on the net. That's going to be interesting talking to him. We have Michael Idema coming up with Ascosia PBX. It's a sort of a 20-megabyte Linux install that has a full Asterisk server in it. I'm looking forward to hearing about that. Guillermo Amaral is coming on. He's a big guy in the open source community in Mexico. He's going to talk about some of the conferences that happened there. We also have just added to the schedule Thomas Cherry Holmes. What a great name. Thomas Cherry Holmes. He works with the Linux MCE project, which is the, I forgot what it is. Darn it. Do you know what Linux MCE is?
I have no idea whatever, I'm afraid.
I have it in my notes somewhere else, but I can't read it here. It's whatever it is. It's cool. It's cool. That's all I know. It's got to be cool. And then Mark also just added to the schedule, Mark Phillips and Andy Gross talking about the RIAC, web or RIAC database, which is another one of these NoSQL databases, key value stores. I've actually mentioned a couple times in the show in the past. So we're bringing them on. Also just added, boy, I tell you, I did a whole lot of work last week to add a bunch of new guests. Stephen Heminger with the Viana project. And I don't remember what that's about either. Where are my notes? Where are my notes? I copied the titles, but I forgot to copy what they are in the cut and paste on this. Anyway, listen to the show.
We'll just have to listen in, won't we? Because we'll never find out what it is unless we listen in.
Exactly. Oh, this last one I know, though. Dan Scott and Mike Rylander with the Evergreen Open Source Library Project. So apparently they built a big sort of central management for checking stuff in and out of libraries, knowing what's on the shelves and stuff. And it's being used by hundreds and hundreds of libraries all across the nation. So I'll be really good to talk to them as well. So anyway, lots of great guests coming up. Lots of great co-hosts again. Thank you again, Simon, for coming back as a co-host. Really appreciate that.
Absolutely, my pleasure. I look forward to, if you ever have me back again, then I'd be delighted to do it.
And if I don't have you back again, would you still be delighted? No, that wouldn't work that way.
I just have to sit here eating my chocolate drops.
And where do we find out more about you? Where are you on the net?
You'll find me at webmink.com on the internet, where you'll find me blogging most days. I have a column on IDG's Computer World UK. You'll find me on the Open Source Initiative, but it's all aggregated there on webmink.com.
Well, that makes it really simple. One-stop shopping for the Simon guy here. That's really good. By the way, earlier in the show, I said I'm being asked a question, which I asked to the guests, and it's because we have a live channel. When we tape this thing Wednesday mornings Pacific time, 9:30, we actually have a live chat channel, and if you're watching the show live while it's being taped, you can actually inject questions like one of our listeners did. So you can get to it by going to live.twit.tv at the appropriate time. The schedules are all listed there as well, including an iCal link that you can put in your calendar to figure out Google Calendar or your subscription calendar to figure out when we're actually taping and what we're doing, which I apparently don't know right now because I'm keep babbling now. But I think probably it's because I'm pretty much done with this show. So except you can follow me on Twitter at Twitter is Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, and you can find out all about where I'm going to be and what's going on with that. So without further ado, once again, Simon, thank you very much for coming on today's show.
My pleasure. Great to see you.
And we'll see you all next time on Floss Weekly.